So it's my great pleasure to welcome Jessica Frazier, who's a lecturer at Trinity College, Oxford, and a research fellow at the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies. Jessica's books include Reality, Religion and Passion, Hindu Worldviews, Theory of Self, Ritual and Reality, and Gadamer on Religion, which is forthcoming this year. And her edited books include The Bloomsbury Companion to Hindu Studies, and she's also editor of the Journal of Hindu Studies. Today her topic is knowledge and selfhood in Hindu traditions. Jessica, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm so not talking about knowledge and selfhood.
Sorry, Taylor.
Not even going close. So I've been, as one of the, as Tim said, yeah, so actually I'm not going to do it at all. Partly because this is an interesting, so thank you for the opportunity to talk here, and it's an interesting chance to think about this theoretically, actually. So a lot of us are doing, some of us are theorizing about it, some of us are doing it. I often find myself end up trying to do global philosophy of religion, but then you've got that awkward thing where, where's the theory, how do we stand? I write a little paragraph to justify my theory, I move on. So this is a nice chance actually to properly try and bring out some of what the ground of this would be, and as Mikkel pointed out, there's a lot of this going on at the moment. I'll refer to some of the people who are trying to do this kind of global philosophy in a second. So, and really what I'm doing, I thought, what should I talk about? Should I talk about self? And a lot of the theory I'm talking about here is taken from the last book I did, which is on theories of self in Hinduism, where it makes an argument to apply some of the early classical Indian ideas to broader concepts of the self in a way that's already being done by someone called Janardhan Ganeri, who's at...
Sussex.
Where is he?
Sussex.
No, he used to be at Sussex. Oh. He's now at NUS... Oh. Abu Dhabi or something glamorous like that. So a lot of people who are taking the material, exactly as Victoria sort of said, taking the material and applying them here, in this case, to questions that are classic to Western philosophy, but acknowledging that the questions may, in fact, be wider themselves. And it also relates to my next book after Gadamer, which... Cambridge has a philosophy and religion and the humanities series, which is all, of course, Western philosophy. And they finally said, oh, would you like to do something on Hindu stuff? Not too Hindu, but a little bit Hindu, but let's understand it. That'd be really cool. So this is also helping me to write the theory chapter for that. So that's kind of where I'm standing, where it's coming from. And just to situate myself... and very much continuing the theme of decategorizing and decolonizing and deboundarifying what it means to work across traditions and open up that resource much more broadly. But also to think about what it means to do comparative philosophy, oh, that's a terrible phrase, global philosophy. Let's call it, oh, let's go crazy, philosophy. across, quote unquote, the range of sources and questions, let's take out the word religion or culture altogether. What it looks like to do that, and what it looks like to do it with a certain amount of self-reflexivity about what's happening and what's different from other kinds. What is gained by doing it this way? Right. It's really important to, I think, articulate philosophically why it's useful to do this kind of thing. There's a lot of moral, social impetus to do global philosophy because it looks good, sounds good, makes students feel enfranchised. Those are all valid and valuable purposes, but for a philosopher, it doesn't hold much weight. And I think it undersells the idea that this is conceptually useful. So I want to emphasize the idea that this doesn't just create happy little classrooms or more understanding people. I think those are important, but I think it's almost more important to be able to say this is already useful for better philosophy. Right, so that's kind of where I'm trying to move towards here. And that's partly thanks to, I think, my enjoying a new Tim's paper, because instead of going, where does that stand within the categories of the disciplines, I just thought, hey, he's this really cool philosopher prophet over there. Is he a religious prophet? Is he a philosopher? I'm not really sure, but I kind of like both, and let's run with it. So I'm affirming that and affirming its creative dimension as well. So, to dive in a little bit. the view from above, which actually is a phrase that's introduced by Pierre Hadot in relation to the Stoics and to Plato and early classical Greek thinkers, for whom to do philosophy was to try and gain a view from above of the world, but also of ideas more broadly. And I want to ask the question, what if multiple approaches to multiple themes, so back to Victoria's thing, multiple themes or questions or issues or topics, to which we take multiple approaches. What if that gives us a new understanding of the field, of thought in general, a kind of a view from above? What if there's something special and useful about this? And in this light, we might say that the old paths to doing philosophy were either mono-traditional, okay, so classic Western philosophy, and their goals were very concrete and very important to help us remember what philosophy is doing. I think it's wrong to kind of demonize classic philosophy within a single tradition. It was analytic, aiming at deductively interrogating the reasons behind holding certain things. It was also often creative, and this is something that gets forgotten in faculties that have a less of a metaphysical, actively creative metaphysical dimension to them. We tend to just receive theories, critique them, accept or reject, and maybe refine. But classic metaphysics also has a creative dimension where you're creating models, you're creating theories, you're abductively looking at data, seeking out the explanatory, good explanations, models that have good explanatory power, and building theories as well. And that's important, I think, to see that that's what some of the things that philosophy does. It questions, it interrogates, it offers solutions to problems, it creates new theories. Right, and that's going to be significant for what we want to say here. What then happened, of course, is that there was the move towards a kind of comparativism, and the word comparative, saying earlier, has been somewhat demonized, I think, partly because it was related to the idea of a kind of equivalentism. How we do comparison is through setting up equivalences, and equivalences are kind of when everything went pear-shaped in the comparative study of religion. It's tempting, it's exciting to see alternatives, but generally it's seen as bad because the equivalence is once we go under the first, second, or third layer, deeper into the roots under the ground, the equivalences were so often wrong. So that's I think I entered the study of religion just as that was becoming recognized to be problematic. And I had supervisors and professors who were doing that, so excited to realize that the self and the soul in three different traditions were all the same. And then their books within 10 years were completely unreadable, and you mustn't ever reference them ever, ever, ever. So that we moved on from. What kind of seemed to come after that was what you might call a dialogical approach. So a lot of the people who were doing equivalentism moved into dialogue, and that reflects this shift towards justifying comparative or global approaches as ethically motivated, bringing people together, helping communities relate. The dialogical hermeneutics, which often drew on Hans-Georg Gadamer, who's my guy, my Gandalf, as my head of department once put it, was appealing in many ways. It was aimed at a mutual project of understanding, of course. It was explicitly creative, so it's really important to see that when Gadamer talks about a fusion of horizons, he means the creation of a new horizon. The fusion of horizons is never just two people figuring each other out, they're always making something new. But it was also problematic, because as the dialogical hermeneutic perspective entered into the field, it was largely motivated, A, as a methodological check on existing ideas of understanding. So it was large, Truth and Method, I think, which is, if you've ever tried to read it, it's possibly the most boring book in 20th century philosophy. It's extraordinarily tedious. And I love, he's Gandalf, but that's clearly true. And he himself complained in later life that it was taken as a kind of a sort of a slap on the hand for classic philosophy. So you think you're understanding Joe, you're not really understanding Joe, you're understanding your understanding of Joe, which is cool if you're cool and Joe's cool. That's basically what Gadamer seems to then do. And he complained later that he wished that he'd chosen a different title. And in fact, his wife chastised him because she said, you can't write directly Hans-Georg, you always write in gads. And gad was her term for something where he goes off on a tangent that takes 60 pages and leads us back through 17th century German philosophy before he can make the point he originally aimed at. So he gets lost, and all we see is the idea that we need to think differently about our understanding and accept that we never really get Lao Tzu or whatever. Also, I think generally, Galileo was seen as being something you take on in order to be ethically cool, again, so you're there for the communal benefit of the speakers. It's in order not to talk over your opponent or interlocutor that you adopt the dialogical perspective, in order to respect them, to acknowledge that you haven't pretended that you understand them fully, and that's it. So there's a kind of an ethical reception and an epistemological and methodological reception of Gadamer, but not a fuller understanding of what necessarily he's trying to do. And indeed, I think really importantly, hermeneutics and his whole approach was not seen to be philosophically robust in the sense of being for the benefit of the ideas. You don't enter into a dialogical scheme of understanding the other for the benefit of creating new, better ideas. Right, so there's another element in which Gadamer is seen as merely trying to prevent problems in philosophy, but not doing or showing us what it is to do serious, new, constructive philosophy. And that I want to kind of go against and show how I think global philosophy does contribute to that sort of project. So what might be new paths? Well, one of the approaches that gets taken at the moment is simply that people are saying, let's do mono-traditional philosophy. Or, no, let me take that back, mono-traditional history of philosophy, but let's do it with a lot of traditions in parallel. So that's where we get what you might call parallel histories of philosophy. And one example of that, actually, is if anyone's heard of Peter Adamson and the Global Philosophy Project, it's called History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps. He's at King's London and Ludwig's Maximilian University, in Munich, and he's tried to basically get everyone he can think of that he's ever met who works on any philosophical tradition in or outside the West to tell us some stuff and to make it all accessible so that people will have the resource to do Islamic, which is his tradition, Hindu, Chinese, etc., etc. When I saw him, having produced hours and days worth of time in terms of recordings, and indeed lots and lots of words about these traditions and a number of publications, he apologized that he hadn't yet gotten onto African, etc., and other traditions. But he said, I will. It's a life's work. So learning all the traditions as a resource for all or any questions in philosophy, right? Letting the problems perhaps expand, because you're not only reading about what people's solutions to concepts of the self were, but also what other projects were in other traditions. So there's an implicit expansion of what philosophy does through this, but not an explicit one. So that's one approach, and it can lead to this notion of broader questions being set in philosophy. You know, we have these very set list, set canon of questions that fill the philosophy syllabus. And students go in. I had my dearest friend said, I want to do philosophy. I want to find out about life and redefine everything. She got to the philosophy department at St. Andrews and was heartbroken to find out how little she was going to get to find out about, essentially. And so this notion that we're broadening the range of questions because other valid, important, philosophically interesting questions are being asked in other places. And then we're pooling the resources. So this is back to Victoria's paper again. We're also saying, once you've asked the question, whichever question it is, can we get a wider range of answers by looking at a wider range of sources? And we'll come back to why that's useful, but of course it is. Not least because, as Nietzsche pointed out, each tradition builds in not only its questions, but its own assumptions in trying to answer those questions, and therefore builds in its own inhibiting assumptions as well, its own mistakes, its own problems. So that if you can move to another tradition, of course, you get suggestions that will bypass the inhibiting factors that maybe have stopped everyone post-Plato from coming up with a really valid notion of being. This is an old idea, of course, when Max Müller stated this early on, Max Müller being terribly, terribly unfashionable, but actually rather wonderful in his wacky way. He writes in his introduction to, I think it was the Upanishads, to the patient reader, these Hindu texts will open a new view of the history of the human race, of that one race to which we all belong, controversial thing to say at the time, with all the fibres of our flesh and all the hopes of our soul. And the ideas that this would lead, and I'm kind of laying the groundwork here, you know all this, but it's good to go back and just see what people hoped for in the beginning. The hope is that this will lead to a new understanding of the broader reaches of each theme in relation to the other themes, in the implications of each question, in its variations. So once we start seeing, for instance, the concept of the self or concept of the soul and arguments for immortality in the West and comparing them with Buddhist critiques of self and then with Hindu notions of immortality, which factor in problems of loss of particularity of the individual personality, for instance, you get a bigger sense of what thinking about the essence of self and potential life beyond death might look like in terms of its implications, its variations, its internal tensions, its underlying priorities, assumptions, and desires, the choices that the theorist makes, and the alternatives that they do or do not choose to take. We're getting a bigger picture. And Bimal Matalal, the great Indian philosopher trained in both traditions, wrote, "Indeed, this is going to be difficult to use such resources at first. Certain Sanskrit terms," he said, "will be problematic in the first instance, but certain Sanskrit terms," he hopes, "will eventually find their way into the modern writings about ancient philosophy. When terms like dharma, paksha, and sadhya will be just as much tolerated as certain Greek words like endoxa, elenchos, and eudaimonia." So he has this ideal of a future world where we've got words from a range of traditions that we're using, like doxastic is going to be there alongside X, Y, Z, and whatever comes after Z. So there is an ideal out there of what this in-action philosophy is going to look like and how useful it's going to be. And we can see some people trying to do it. So the idea is that people are identifying the questions that will change your life and make your head explode, as in the picture, whatever those turn out to be, so we don't necessarily stick with the canon. For Guneri, he's very firmly, and I think he would be happy to say he's explicitly guided. So this is Janardhan, who writes particularly about himself. He'd argue he's explicitly guided by the guiding concerns of Western philosophy. I don't think he's embarrassed about that. And I don't know that he needs to be embarrassed about that. He's trained in Western philosophy. Those are his concerns. The self is of great interest. And for that purpose, he finds the Buddhist critique of continuity in mind and experience to be absolutely central, hugely useful, and far more sophisticated than anything he's come across elsewhere. So he's put it to work using Dharmakirti's theory, and recently wrote a book called something like Attention, Not Self, or something like that. So he's created a theory, which is his new theory, which he's not pinning to either tradition based on that resource. And so too, I think, there's been a debate with people like Mark Sideritz and Jay Garfield, who writes about the way in which Madhyamaka skepticism, Nagarjuna, the famous super skeptic of language and meaning, can actually help us to frame a more functional philosophy of truth, or rather deconstructed truth. So we've got people doing that. And indeed, at some point thinking about this, I realize that's kind of what I'm doing, insofar as I'm interested in the way that multiple theories of self can give us more enriching models with greater sense of particular things I'm interested in. Again, what is it that I'm interested in? What problem am I interested to answer? Self models that entail greater appreciation of fluidity or creativity or mystery, something that is a different idea from the set self, which was seen as an inherited, already built thing that we negotiate, rather a kind of a creative participatory notion of one's own self as it emerges as a project in life. That's my own question, not one necessarily that I'm getting from somewhere else. So again, notice a creative state. And also just some fundamental ontology, and hence the connection between Heidegger and Vedanta. But of course, what has often been the issue with this is that we've got equivalencism coming in again. Right. When I ask for a new theory of self, and I compare, actually, but I can move from self to ideas of divine being. So at one point, I thought for this conference, let's take an example, kind of as Thaisi's done, working on what it means to look for things that will engage one's need for a source of consolation. And I was particularly interested in religion as something rather that's looking at notions of being that are contrapuntal, that offer a counterpoint to the kind of experience or world or reality that we experience in everyday life. Contrapuntal notions of divine or ultimate being. That's one of my big interests, and that's what the the Cambridge book would be on. So what would it mean for me to try and compare, I thought, Advaita Hindu non-dualism with whatever the equivalent would be in the West? And immediately one's head starts to spin. What's the equivalent? What would be other equivalent ideas that would be helpful to bring into this? And I thought, oh, the doctrine of divine simplicity, my favorite doctrine in the philosophy of religion, the one that nobody studies anymore. Completely crazy. Yes, God's essence and his existence are the same thing, and all of his attributes are identical, so that omniscience, omnipotence, and omnibenevolence are identical attributes, which is impossible, but true for God. How cool. Wow. Man, it's bonkers. But also incredibly fertile, if you look at it in terms of Platonic notions of an ideal conception of being. In fact, very much fits with Anselm's notion of God as a perfection, as perfection, and a rethinking of what perfection would be that is the perfection of all things. It's almost a throwback directly to To Agathon, the idea of the good, as Plato frames it. But look, as soon as I set up that equivalence, I run into this problem of the two ideas being highly dissimilar in many ways. And how are we going to deal with this? And that's where I think, on one hand, Gadamer points us to certain things. So if I use Gadamer as my Gandalf, he'd want to point us to deep contextualization, which we all know about anyway, we all aim to do, right? But which is itself, I think, still one of the great challenges of the discipline. You know, think of sending your paper in for the ref if you're in a UK university, and someone saying, well, she just picked up divine simplicity and the Advaita of Shankara, but to what extent are they the same? Has she contextualized it properly? Has she taken into account? Right. So what does it mean to do that? And what we've got here is a reminder of the complexity and richness of each idea's fabric. So this is something I think that the Western tradition tends to obscure to itself, often for good reasons, but in canonizing certain ideas or themes or problems, we tend to make them seem simpler than they are. So you say to the students, here's an issue about, for instance, the problem of evil. Here's what omnibenevolence is, right? And look at how it's problematic. And then the rest of the weeks or days that they spend on that problem theme are actually about looking into the different things that omnibenevolence is, how it's been motivated by a range of different ideas and ideals in Western history, how benevolence itself is interpreted very widely, as for instance pacifism and compassion are. So you then have a hermeneutic unpacking of what had appeared to be the idea in question. And in fact, often the solution comes out of the hermeneutic unpacking. Right. And often that's, I think, hidden, that's cloaked in classic analytic philosophy. And indeed, Gadamer would say, well, that's partly because the ideas are coming out of what is already an internally pluralistic tradition. Right. So the Western tradition, as a single tradition, we all know is not true, even though the genealogy that was introduced by people from Thomas to Heidegger of a tradition that comes out of Plato has become quite a popular narrative. Of course, in fact, that's really not how it is. And I told a story, I think the other night, about Gadamer, but for Gadamer, Heidegger and so many before him were terrible scholars. They failed to be global, multicultural scholars because they weren't actually studying the original material properly. So people would read Plato, they would not read necessarily the proper surrounding texts. They would not always necessarily do good study of the philological background of the words being used. They knew nothing about Greek religion and how these words and ideas fitted into existing religious concepts. They ignored references in Plato that often were tying into other concepts, other theories, and religious ideas. And so they got a very poor idea. And so it was a reminder that, you know, if you talk about the West, you're talking about not only you talk about the Bible as a source, but that is cult, cosmology, narrative, poetry. You may talk about Greek philosophy, but that too is philosophy, as well as incorporating a mix of different elements like indigenous mystery cults and its new translation into biblical forms. Greek philosophy is not just Plato and Aristotle, it is others as well. The scholastic tradition is always paralleled by mystical or humanistic equivalents. You've also got the Cartesian, the naturalist, the scientific, the Hegelian, the Kantian, the Kierkegaardian, phenomenological, and the analytic. It's a deeply plural tradition, and I won't go through the Indian equivalents, but again, people talk about Vedanta and actually the internal complexity of not only Vedanta, but of course the whole of the tradition is enormous. So one of the first steps is just to recognize that richness of the fabric. And if you take that into a hermeneutic model, what that means is when you do the philosophy or a global philosophy of religion, you're not just talking about ideas, you're always talking about questions. Gadamer says every idea is really a question that's come out of a certain background or context that's shaping the question. Right? So someone says, I'm looking for an idea of the soul that can persist beyond the death of the body. And Gadamer says that's not an idea, that's a question that comes out of a set of motivating concerns to do with what we think the soul looks like, what we think death is, what we want to continue, what the historical motivation for it is, etc., etc. Right? So instead of seeing a single node, you're seeing, if you like, a web or a set of roots. And this is, for that tradition, quite an important point to make. You never get just ideas, you always get questions, and each question is really kind of a knot in a broader web of ideas and notions that are interrelated. So, actually, Perret makes an interesting distinction here. He says that in a proper global philosophy of religion, we won't be doing curatorial philosophy. Here is an idea of the soul, here is an idea of the non-self, and here is an idea of something else, the mind, which simply identifies the ideas and then puts them on shelves but doesn't relate them. Nor should we be doing exoticist philosophy, which looks at the other ideas that we're not familiar with and marvels at their difference, right? Which I think is actually sometimes useful in and of itself. He says that's not ultimately the goal, and that is something that people do. Nor should it be, let's just say, magisterial philosophy, where we are essentially saying, oh, here is our idea, but there is their idea, it's interesting, and we can borrow some bits of it. He says it should be genuinely interlocutory. So each idea is genuinely questioning and changing all of the others. And so that would lead us, that would encourage us to want to try and contextualize our truths in a slightly different way. So a deep contextualization, following the kind of methods that are used in early hermeneutic sources, might include identifying an idea in terms of what it desires to know. Okay, so let's say you're looking for a model of the soul after death. What does it really want to know this for? What is it trying to achieve? Is it trying to achieve something that we want to live into, we want to find appealing as an ongoing being? What assumptions is it based on? What cosmological assumptions are already informed? What textual sources is it using? What kinds of examples does it have in the back of its mind? Very important. What methods is it going to use to solve the question? What are the associated debates or ideas that we need to understand as themselves being rethought at that time in history in order to get it right? What models are then brought forward, and in what ways do those models get refined? And if you tried to do that, it could turn into something really messy like that that I won't take you through, but which in itself I think can be useful. So let's say we were trying to compare the Christian doctrine of divine simplicity with Advaita in Vedanta. Right? What we'd end up doing is say, why do they want to know? What is the doctrine of divine simplicity there for? Is it a counterpoint to the ideas of decay and decomposition and the medieval fear of that? Why do the Indians want to know? Oh, for them it's because there's an ideal in the Upanishads of if you can know any truth that transcends change, you become a being that transcends change. They've got slightly different ways of going through it. The assumptions and cosmological bases, the different texts that they're using, the kind of examples that they're actually drawing on. So the Indians talk a lot about air, consciousness. Agency is a single unifying kind of entity, right? Agency isn't an entity in the way that it's looked at in Plato or Aristotle, but the Indians look at agency itself, my ability to dance and move, as having a potentiality for plurality, but being one. We talked about that a little bit in terms of passivism That's an actual thing. Whereas you've got very different ideas, for instance, number for Plato as an idea of a kind of pure being as coming through here. And you can go all the way through that and you get a very different root system, if you like. What comes out of it is something that is an idea that is much more widely grounded and in a way includes its own tensions and complexities. And in an ideal world, moving towards what a global philosophy might look like if it was doing not just across traditions but across a range of multiple traditions, you don't just get dialogue but you get something like what you might call plurilogue. Right? So not just how does my tradition look like yours or not, but what does it mean to see how multiple conceptions of self or divine being or what have you would be put together? Right. So if Gadamer talks about a dialogical hermeneutics, here we might have a choral hermeneutics. And he uses the image of an organ which plays many notes at once. Two notes, you're trying to figure out which one sounds good. Many notes, you get a new sound coming out of that organ, which has its own intrinsic value. So what you would do then is you take these each idea which has been complexified, let's say the doctrine of divine simplicity now has a broader contextual basis. The idea of Brahman as a single unity now has a broader grounding in history and its backgrounds. And maybe you can do the same with other traditions as well. And you start to see all of them in relation. And once you start to see that, see the connections and the differences between them, you start to see their connection to other ideas as well. So you might say, how do we fit in animist spirit worlds? They're not the same. They're not assumed to be non-dual, but they are counterpoints to everyday reality. Where do we draw the line? Do we keep them out of our study of what it is to have a different kind of being? Or do we keep them in, but we respect precisely what the differences and similarities are? What about the notions of a causal grounding, a cause or a source of everything? For a lot of traditions, that's how they deal with the idea of something which is not worldly reality. Or concepts of purity become really important for people trying to define concepts of transcendence. What about those ideas? How do they fit in? Or abstract realities of the cultures which theorize the notion of the imagination or of the realm of ideas as opposed to the physical. What I want to point to is the way in which this cluster of ideas are related. And in a sense, there is no center to them. What there is if you look over them, is a range of different themes which are interrelated coming into view. To do with non-physicalness, to do with permanentness, to do with the desire for a counterpoint to the world that we know, to do with things like ideals of abstraction, and a range of other things. So what you're getting at the high level of this global picture is not just an answer to one question or an answer to another question, but rather a kind of a view from above of how a range of ideas interrelate. You're getting a kind of a concept map. And that itself is something that a few thinkers have tried to say is an interesting goal in itself. Is it philosophy in the classical sense, where philosophy tries to clarify concepts or to identify problems in reasoning or to come up with reasonable models for particular things? Philosophy in some ways has tended to be quite applied to specific problems and issues. This is not quite that. It's almost hermeneutic in its goal. That is, it seeks simply to understand the wider array or landscape of the ideas that you can draw on. Gadamer writes about this. He says, every word breaks forth as if from a center and is related to a whole. So every idea gives you a center point to start from. It's a bit like Tim trying to say, where am I going to start from when I've got all these ideas to bring into a single narrative? It gives you a center, but it relates you wider and wider to that whole, through which it alone is a word. Every word causes the whole of the language to which it belongs to resonate, and the whole worldview that underlies it to appear, right? So if you take the idea, and instead of trying to clarify what is divine being, but move outward from it as in a ripple to a range of concepts that inform our broader understanding of that idea in the first place, you get a different kind of philosophy emerging. Gilles Deleuze helps maybe with this. He wants to bring up the way in which truths should be seen as internal multiplicities. Each word is a virtual one that is always the index of a multiplicity, an event, a singularity, a life. So that now when we do the metaphysics
of causality or the metaphysics of identity or concepts of divine being, you're always looking at a kind of a cloud, a word cloud, a cluster, if you like. And that could be a valuable thing in and of itself. And that sort of emphasizes the creative stake in philosophy and embraces it. So Deleuze, if you apply him here, one of the interesting things about him is he wants to remind us that that multiplicity means that whenever we speak, we're creating new ideas. We're not just addressing the old idea, as it were, of the self or of the divine being, particularly when we engage with a new context. And in the context of global philosophy, when we bring in new resources, we're creating new words. What we call virtual is not something that lacks reality, but something that is engaged in a process of actualization, following the plane that gives it its particular reality. So it's always actualizing some potentiality that's hidden within. The imminent event is actualized in a state of things and of the lived that made it happen. Right? So there's a constant making new and concrete of hidden possibilities. One of the implications of this, kind of drawing towards an idea of what the overall summary of what this might then look like would be, is that there are no discrete ideas anymore. So all our talk about where the boundaries should go between traditions, or indeed between ideas, in a way gets lost in the hermeneutic model. And that's where you get this talk of the hermeneutic web. The hermeneutic conception of ideas is of a continuum. And we're invited to wonder at the internal richness of the idea fabric. Okay, this isn't philosophy as problem solving, this is philosophy as view of the idea fabric, if you like. And to explore it, to go see what else is hidden within potential concepts of the self that we haven't brought up yet, perhaps. To harness it, to realize that we can get a new concept of the self out of Tibetan shamanic practice, perhaps, that is something we haven't seen before and can be useful in all kinds of ways. And to add to it, to say, gosh, I just realized that between the Tibetan model and the Berber model of northeastern Morocco, I can see actually something implied that would work in such and such a way, be coherent, and in fact useful in certain respects. So it's acknowledging that not only are we seeing the existing ideas, but by being allowed to see the lines in between them, and indeed the spaces where they haven't yet gone, we're being pointed towards actually actively making new ideas. And this is important. Rather than impose or erase boundaries, we now accept continuums. Gadamer refers us to Plato's Parmenides, where he talks about, famously, you know, the Plato of the Republic, classical period Plato, says there's the idea of the chair, there's the idea of the table, there's the idea of the dog, and the idea of yellow. And in late Plato, depending on who you read, in texts like the Parmenides, the Theaetetus, and the Seventh Letter, he says, no, actually, let's look at the example of a tall man, a short man, and a man who's in between. Right? The man in between, is he short or is he tall? Well, he's tall relative to the short man, short relative to the tall man. It's a continuum. And in the Parmenides, you see, of course, those notion of discrete ideas or concepts being problematized in the direction of a continuum, which then asks us, in a sense, to start to draw our own lines. I can't remember which, I think it's the Seventh Letter, he uses the example of an army in flight. Plato says, when an army is standing still, it's standing still. When it's traveling, it's traveling. But what is the moment at which the army starts to flee from the battle? When the first man moves? When the second? Does it take 10 men? When half of the army is moving? He says there is no way to draw that line as a discrete certainty. In fact, he's pointing to a kind of relativism, which is not a negative relativism, which means there is no meaning, but rather a relativism that invites us to try and establish where we want to see the concepts as line. I won't go into the Germano-Cartesian blick. A worldview, but it challenges the notion of worldviews as discrete, separate things. Right. This, in theory, by the way, is possible because we're not doing history of religions or just religious studies here. We're doing the philosophy of religion. It's the philosophy of religious ideas, not just study of religious histories, and if we're doing philosophy of religious ideas, we get to try and map the ideas in themselves and in relation to each other, without necessarily feeling that we have to put them on the right shelves, as it were. So the selection of ideas is always creative. and drawing towards a close. That means there's an emphasis on our understanding of ourselves as choosing questions. Right? And I think that goes back to kind of what I liked about Tim. Let's say Arif is teaching a classic philosophy syllabus, and this is important and valuable because these are questions that the West has chosen to find important, partly because of the trajectory they come out of. But it need not be that way, and if we look at a broader range, maybe we have to actively choose which questions we find interesting in any particular context. And someone will go to perhaps the chooser and say, hey man, that's just your choice. That is determined by your own cultural and historical background. And Gadamer would stand next to that man and put his hand on his shoulder and say, every choice is just a choice, someone's choice, relative to the context. It always has been, and that's fine, right? As long as we articulate that, it's actually particularly useful. The fallacy is in assuming that the canon of established philosophical ideas are the ones, the proper ones. So in that sense, you always have to embrace the creativity of it. So rather than doing the classic philosophy syllabus where we look at evidence for religious belief, God, immortality, and theodicy, or even looking for equivalences where we look at the Christian God, but then the Vedantic Brahman, oh, and I guess Tao or the rule of heaven, but that's a bit complicated. It's not really an equivalent. Head explodes. Instead, we say, what are the questions that we find most interesting? And we choose them, in a sense, as we will, according to what we find important. So perhaps Christian theodicy is particularly juicy. Vedantic cognitivism, if you like, is particularly interesting epistemologically. Islamic debates about free will are particularly exciting, or Buddhist notions of identity, etc., etc. So in a way, I'm supporting this notion that Tim Nepper is seeking new questions and disseminating them afresh. As long as he's aware that he's thinking about his own interests and the criteria that determine them. I think that in a way what's going on in that project is a kind of a new existentialism. It's an existentialist philosophy of religion, because what it's doing is it says, I want to speak to universal human concerns, and they are going to guide my choice of questions. Each concern you choose is a focus from which you can build outwards, depending on which ideas from whatever tradition are most useful. So summarizing, essentially, if this represents a kind of a view from above, an idea mapping, in and amongst which we can choose what questions we want to ask and what answers we give, what do we learn? Well, we get new questions, new ways of answering questions, new answers to the questions, right? So it's a reform of philosophy that's implied. We also get a kind of meta-philosophy out of global philosophizing. Meta-insights into the kinds of questions that arise when people do philosophy. What their potential variants are, philosophy of mind, of identity, of metaphysics, well, actually, there are a huge variation within them. What motivates them? Nobody asks why philosophy of mind, but there are concrete, important questions why that's such a big thing, right? Or why metaphysics became really unfashionable and then came back in again. There are underlying motivations. And what spaces remain concerning what has not been said? All too little do we look at the classic canon and say, what have we missed out? What's new, what's cool, what's important? Universally, not just necessarily in relation to our time. So we get meta-insights into the relational ideas and the nature of philosophical doctrines per se. And just by way of example, last two slides, it's actually worth noticing that this isn't new. This isn't some sort of future scientific people in spacesuits and white surfaces sort of thing. It's actually already what Nietzsche was doing, for instance, just by way of example. I always put Hegel at the beginning of this, and I think the problem with Hegel is he's always particularly clearly assimilationist. He says, oh, let's look at India. But India, you're fun, you're interesting, but you're wrong. And he does that in a way that's kind of generalizing across the tradition. But Nietzsche, I think, is already within intra-tradition philosophizing in this way. He's already looking at philosophies as something from which he can make competing selections. We've got the Western tradition, let's reject this and take this. He wants to dig beneath Socrates and the Buddha. He wants to say, wait a second, what's motivating them? What's the context? What are the tensions? And in doing this and looking for alternative sources, he wants to reveal new insights. He thinks once he's looked from above at them and their alternatives in relation to the broader context, he says he can see new insights into what belief is more generally, what truth is as a result, how what we think of as truth relates to our notion of belief, how that's tied into this attitude of conviction that is so central, and what it means to be able to live with or without conviction. That's the uncharted space that he then wants to move into. Heidegger is doing something similar. He's digging back into history for an alternative genealogy in relation to being, of course, revealing new insights into our conceptualization of being. Oh my God, we've been reifying it since Aristotle. What a mess. Looking for alternatives. Maybe Meister Eckhart can help. And the motivations, all of which he's going to use to rethink the phenomenon that we call being. So it's telling him about what it means to, for all these cultures to try and do what they're doing when they're looking for concepts of being, and also what they're missing, and also what all of them have in common, almost Marion-like, as a motivator for the concept in the first place. And this results in huge creative output from the post-Heideggerians who try and come up with a huge range of new ontologies. So Gadamer, Levinas, Derrida, Marion, Deleuze are all coming out of the creative space that Heidegger's actually opened up when he does this. And we can see something similar happening in India. So last slide. I suppose then I want to say that if global philosophy is global philosophy, it's always going to be a creative global philosophy. It's going to be hermeneutic in the sense that it's about seeing and understanding the fabric of the ideas. It's going to be creative in the sense that it's always already forcing us to be creative. We might as well embrace it and do it more explicitly. It heals mistakes in that it overcomes inhibiting assumptions and offers new solutions. But it also expands possibilities, suggests new questions, new interpretations, against a field of multiple answers and models, encouraging creativity. And what's important here is to remember that I think it's not the case that when we talk about philosophy of mind or metaphysics or whatever, we're talking about things for which there is a right or a wrong answer that we're trying to find. Many, perhaps most of the issues in philosophy, perhaps across all traditions, are multiply interpretable, right? So how you interpret the self, there can be one truth about what the self is, but different ways of describing it. And the same is true about the fabric of being, about the chair. The same is true about a whole range of things, right? Ways that we understand knowledge can be many different things, and they needn't be in conflict. So it's actually useful then to have these different resources to understand the fabric of ideas that grow around a single reality. This isn't there is no relativism implied here necessarily. There may be real realities and questions to describe here, but it'd still be useful to have lots of different models to apply. So that when Jnana Guneri overcomes the unitary ontology of the self in the West by reference to Buddhism, or Heidegger overcomes the reification of being by reference to Heraclitus and Taoism, they're doing something terribly important and giving us another way of looking at reality that has valid other ways to be looked at. And this is something that then changes philosophy from a yes or no discipline into this kind of hermeneutic view from above, which is trying to map out the possible ideas that are still waiting out there to be discovered. Okay, I think that's it. Thank you for staying here.